The Characters of Christmas podcast with Dan Darling is brought to you by Life Audio and is part of our Faith Toolkit series. For more inspirational faith-affirming podcasts, visit lifeaudio.com.
Well, welcome, my friends, again to this wonderful time we're having with this podcast called The Characters of Christmas. I hope you've enjoyed them as we are getting ever closer to Christmas Day in anticipation of what God might do in our hearts as we meditate on the first advent of Jesus coming to this earth in human flesh, the Son of God. In this episode, I would love to talk about some very interesting characters in the story of Christmas. These are the surprising people in Jesus' family. Now, I have to tell you, in my own family, I have a son who has my same name. So I'm Daniel Michael Darling Sr. He's Daniel Michael Darling Jr. And that's something that my son, who's 12 right now, is so proud of. And I'm proud of it too. And it's pretty cool, for instance, to get an email from a Daniel Darling Jr. It's like almost like an email from myself. You know, naming our kids is one of the most precious gifts that God gives us parents. We have four children. Besides my son, we have three girls, two of whom were born around Christmas time. So this time of year, we're not only celebrating the birth of Jesus, we're celebrating the birth of Emma and Grace. And like many parents, when we knew we were going to have children, we agonized over the names of our children, looking through baby books and thinking about what names do we like and who can we name them after. But we obviously don't invest the kind of significance in a name for a child as they did in the time of the Bible. In those days, the name had great importance. It signaled not only the type of person that child would be, but signaling to whom they belonged. It's interesting. Today, there is a renewed interest in genealogy, motivated perhaps by the way that the internet's made it easier to kind of trace our family history. So you can go to places like 23andMe or Ancestry DNA, and you can find interesting people in your family line. Well, Matthew begins his gospel, and really the beginning of the Christmas story, with a list of names. And this is the part that most of us, when we're doing our Bible reading through the year plan, see all these names, we go, okay, yeah, kind of glaze over, whatever. There's not many public readings of Scripture that include the genealogy in Matthew or in Luke. But we have to understand that Matthew did not put this list in here because he needed to pad the page count of the gospel. This is not filler. He's making a bold statement about who Jesus is. So he makes a statement, Matthew does, he opens his gospel making an audacious claim. He says, the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, the Son of Abraham. Now Matthew's telling his readers that this itinerant rabbi from Nazareth that you know was arrested on false charges and was executed by the Romans, Joseph's son, the carpenter's son, he's the rightful heir to the throne of David and he's the promised Son of God. And to use today's language, Matthew has the receipts to prove it. He begins first by mentioning two important names. Jesus, he says, is the son of David and son of Abraham. Well, why does this matter? Well, to fully understand this, we have to go back to Genesis. And when God called Abraham to leave his family and everything familiar to go to a place he didn't know, God was doing something with Abraham. From this once pagan man would come a family, and from this family would come a nation. And this is what God promised. Genesis 12, the Lord said to Abraham, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. And I will bless those that bless you. Him who dishonors you, I will curse. And in you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. Genesis 15, he reiterates the promise. Look toward heaven, number the stars. If you're able to number them, so shall your offspring be. So if you're Abraham at the time, it's incomprehensible for him to ponder, how's God going to make from his family a nation, and not just any nation, but a people that would bless all the families on the earth? Like, how in the world is this even possible? And yet this promise was repeated to Isaac and to Jacob and throughout the generations of the people of Israel. Later in Israel's history, God would pluck another man from obscurity and make an even bigger and more impossible promise. God urged Samuel to find David from the shepherd fields and anoint him as Israel's next king. And when David did finally assume the throne of Israel, God said he would preserve the throne of David forever. 2 Samuel 7:12-16, it says, when your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring after you, who shall come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. And he shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. So think about this, a kingdom forever? I mean, think about this, how this sounds to David. Sure, as a monarch, he wanted his son to reign and his son's sons to reign, and he wanted his line and his dynasty to go on and on and on. But even the most narcissistic rulers, when they hear, O king, live forever, they don't usually believe it. They know at some point down the line, that dynasty is going to end. Every dynasty ends, right? How do you ensure your family's in power forever? But this was not hyperbole. God really meant it, and he renewed this promise even after the kingdom of Israel was divided and conquered and centuries after David died and was buried. Here's one promise. Ezekiel 34, I will set up over them one shepherd, my servant David, and he shall feed them. He shall feed them and be their shepherd, and I, the Lord, will be their God, and my servant David shall be prince among them. I am the Lord, I have spoken. So this is the prophet Ezekiel, well after David was president, who's writing to a people who no longer had possession of their land, who were ruled by another conquering kingdom, a people whose idolatry had invited the judgment of God. And yet David continues to remind and renew his promise made to David back in 2 Samuel 7. And there's all kinds of promises throughout the Old Testament that David's promise, that the line of David would go on forever. Jeremiah 23:5 says that, behold, the days are coming, declare the Lord, when I will raise up for David a righteous branch, and he shall reign as king and deal wisely and shall execute justice and righteousness in the land. So Matthew is asserting in his gospel with his opening list of hard to pronounce names that this day has dawned, this day has come. When he says the genealogy of Jesus Christ, son of David, son of Abraham. He's saying that Jesus is the fulfillment of God's promise to Abraham, and Jesus is the new David, promised by the prophets. And in the genealogy, in this list of names, he traces Jesus' legal right to the throne of Israel through Joseph's line. Now in Luke 3, we see Jesus' lineage traced through Mary's family. And you need to notice that both families, both sides, Mary and Joseph, come from the family of David. Joseph from Solomon's family, David's son Solomon's family, and Mary from David's son Nathan's family. So, and Luke actually traces Jesus back to Adam to make the important case that Jesus is fully human and that he is the second Adam come to reverse the curse and rescue humanity. Matthew is making the case that Jesus is the fulfillment of the promise to David. And in fact, even the way he arranges the names is significant. And we don't always pick this up when we read our English translations of the Bible. But in this list of names, in Matthew 1, he divides them up into three lists of 14 generations. First, Abraham to David, then David to the exile, and the exile to Jesus. Now, Matthew didn't include every single generation from Adam to Jesus in this genealogy. Instead, he used 14 generations three times, and this had a specific purpose. You see, the Hebrew language had a device called geometria that used letters as numbers. So the consonants in every Hebrew word would add up to a number. David's names add up to the number 14. D equals 4, V equals 6, D equals 4. So Matthew deliberately repeated this three times as if to emphasize Jesus as the new David. This would give Jewish people reading this, or anyone reading this, a convenient device to remember these names in genealogy. Again, Matthew's not trying to be cute here. He was trying to emphasize his case that Jesus Christ was a son of David. And he's not just any son of David, Matthew's making the case. Plenty of men came along who had the right family heritage, but Matthew says that Jesus is the Christ, the anointed one, the Messiah. Now, why is this important? Well, this is important because everything you and I celebrate at Christmas hinges on this fact. If this baby born in Bethlehem to peasant parents who lived a perfectly sinless life, went to die on a Roman cross, and rose again on the third day is indeed the Christ, well, then it changes everything. It means Christmas is more than just Hallmark movies and trips to grandma's house, but it's the celebration of the birth of the Son of God, the long-promised Messiah. It's the inbreaking of the kingdom of God. Oh, this is so important to understand and worship and recognize this year.
Hey, listeners. If you're a parent, then we've got a show for you. We know that parenting is not for the faint at heart. It can be hard to connect with your child throughout the many stages of their life. That's why Robrina Reddle, host of Mama Take Heart, is back this fall. Wife, mom, writer, podcast host, coffee lover, and military veteran, Robrina has a passion to help you be an influential voice in your daughter's life. In this show, she gives listeners the tools they need to love and lead well in their child's formative years, whether you're looking for ways to intentionally connect or to have hard conversations. You can find the Mama Take Heart podcast on lifeaudio.com or in your favorite podcast app. And don't forget to hit subscribe so you don't miss an episode.
What's interesting is if you look at Jesus' family tree outlined in Matthew and Luke, if you look closely, you have a few questions. Yes, it's awesome that Jesus is the new David, the son of Abraham, the promised Messiah, but look closely at some of the names here. There's a lot of what we would call misfits. David, well, sure, he was Israel's best king, but he's the one who committed adultery and arranged for his mistress' husband to be killed. Abraham, he went out on faith, but didn't he lie about his wife and have a child with his handmaid? And of all the sons of Jacob, I mean, does Jesus have to come from the family of Judah? Judah was not a good character. Like, if you signed up for Ancestry DNA and you found out that these people were in your family tree, I don't know if you'd go tell someone. Hey, honey, I just found out I'm related to a lying adulterer and murderer. And yet, the kind of people Jesus has in his family tree are infamous misfits, not the kind of characters you'd put on your refrigerator. But in this list of names is another countercultural message. These are the kinds of people who make up the family of God. His kingdom, Jesus' kingdom, would remind us, would be the place where the last in line when it comes to holiness would be first, and where the sinners of this world would find refuge. I love what Jesus says in Mark chapter 2, 16 through 17. And the scribes of the Pharisees, when they saw that he was eating with sinners and tax collectors, said to his disciples, "Why does he eat with sinners and tax collectors?" And when Jesus heard it, he said to them, "Those who are well have no need of physician, but those who are sick. I came not to call the righteous, but sinners." Man, this is such good news, my friends. Because though we might pretend, especially this time of year, that we have it all together, we know that there are parts of our lives we'd rather not see exposed to the light of day. We know we're sick. And even in his genealogy, Jesus is telling us the kinds of people who are eligible for his gospel. What great news. Tim Keller says, "The world has always despised people from the wrong places with the wrong credentials. We are always trying to justify ourselves. We need desperately to feel superior to others. And everything about Jesus contradicts and opposes that impulse. My friend, Jesus has come for outsiders and for the sinner, the downcast and the powerless. My friends, he's come for you. He's come for me. What great news that is. Jesus came to save sinners. Now, in the time we have left, I want to focus on four specific people he mentions that make it even more mind-blowing, this strange and wonderful gospel and this strange and wonderful family of God. In this genealogy that Matthew gives, he lists four women. Now, you have to understand, in those days when genealogies were published or written, they did not list women. They listed men because men were considered heads of household. That's who people thought about when they thought about who your father is, who the patriarch is, who carries on the family name, who's responsible, whose you are. Even notice in the Gospels when they say about Jesus, isn't he the carpenter's son? They don't say, isn't he Mary's son? Isn't he the carpenter's son? But Matthew does something countercultural. he lists four women, which tells us something about Christianity. That Christianity always elevates women, that always gives women dignity. It was women who were the first witnesses to the resurrection. It's women who were some of the most believing disciples in Jesus' ministry. And it's four women here who are mentioned in the family tree. And I want to go through all four of these. First, there's the forgotten. Tamar is a name most Jewish people would likely want to forget. And yet here she is. Genesis 38, first as the wife of a woman named Ur, one of the two sons of Judah. These sons were the result of an adulterous relationship Judah had with another Canaanite woman. So she is the daughter-in-law of Judah. She married one of Judah's sons. One of his sons that was a result of a relationship he had with a Canaanite woman. Ur was not a good husband. He was killed by God for his sin. When he died, it was according to custom at the time for his next older brother, Onan, to marry Tamar and continue the family line. This is all told in Genesis 38. But Onan refused to conceive a baby with Tamar. He didn't fulfill his promise. So God struck him dead as well. So she's left alone and bereft. So she waited for the next younger brother. Well, this never happened. So she took things into her own hands, and she dressed up like a prostitute and solicited Judah. And she had a baby with Judah. Judah tried to have her killed, but then he recognized that for her adultery, then it was revealed to him that it was his baby. And yet here she is in the family of God. Her baby is one of Jesus' direct human ancestors. And this tells us that the place of Judah and the place of Tamar and the family of Jesus shows us a kind of interesting contrast between the powerful and the powerless. Judah was a hypocritical leader who covered his sin, who exploited his daughter-in-law to satisfy his passion. And then here's Tamar, helpless and forgotten. And yet in Jesus' new family, both the religious hypocrite and the exploited mistress find their need for grace. The Tamars of the world who are used and abused and discarded and forgotten find refuge in the family of God. Then there's Rahab. We all know the story of Rahab, right? From Joshua chapter 2, when the Jewish spies come in to scout the land of Jericho, she's the one who hides them in her home and protects them from the prying eyes of the government police. And then she misleads those that are trying to find them. She had heard the miracles God had wrought in Israel, and she believed in the Jewish God. She was spared when God destroyed Jericho because of the scarlet cord in her window. She converted to the Jewish faith and married into Israel. But we also know that Rahab was a harlot, a prostitute. Now, we recoil at that word because we think of just what it means. But we have to understand that in ancient times, it's often the only way a vulnerable woman without any resources, any safety net, any family to support them could take care of themselves and could survive. This just doesn't justify the lifestyle, but it reminds us that she was someone who was exploited for her body. But because she provided critical intelligence that helped Israel defeat Jericho, she was given safe harbor in Israel and grafted into the Jewish nation. James, the brother of Jesus, says in James chapter 2, that says that her actions were evidence of a newfound faith. Here she is mentioned in the family of God, and her life is evidence that Jesus is always bringing in outsiders. He's always bringing in those who've been exploited. He's always bringing in those who have damaged reputations. And I just want us to think, as we gather this Christmas to worship, we're tempted to think of ourselves as more righteous than the Rahabs in our world. But in a sense, every human being is as unclean in God's eyes as a prostitute. Paul says this, right? Paul, the observant, faithful Jew, would later say that there is none righteous before God. He saw himself as the chief of sinners. But the good news is that Jesus, by his life and death and resurrection, is bringing Rahabs into his new family. And then there's the exploited, Bathsheba. Now, you don't need an introduction to Bathsheba's story. You just don't. We know that she is the one with whom David had an affair. It's interesting when you read the Old Testament narrative about David. Most of the condemnation and the judgment is for David. And we know this. David is in a position of power. He's the king. He's supposed to be away at battle with his troops, but he's home. He's idle in the castle. He sees Bathsheba bathing and he says, I want to have her. And he, every time he asks, he takes what is not his. Bathsheba's married. David's married. This is a clear case of exploitation. You know, Bathsheba couldn't exactly resist the king. In those days, you didn't resist the request of the king. She conceived with David. The baby died. All her life, she kind of endured heartbreak. Yes, she was the wife of the king, but even later in David's life, we see she's kind of forgotten by him. David exploited Bathsheba. He used his power to get from her what he wanted. It resulted in the death of her husband, the death of her child, and it caused an ugly family split, the seeds of horrible civil war that cost David his son Absalom. Her life was one of difficulty and sorrow. She was probably an unpopular, even despised woman in Israel, and in the history and the reputation of Israel from that point forward. And yet here she appears in Matthew's retelling of the story of Israel and the promise of the Redeemer. She's named by God. If you are a Jewish person reading Matthew's genealogy and you read the name Bathsheba, you're recoiling. You're saying, oh, not her. But she's named by God, a victim of exploitation. And so it is that God sees and knows all of those who are often exploited and abused. And in Jesus, they can find a new family and a new identity. Lastly, there's the outsider. Maybe the most scandalous name in Jesus' genealogy, and that's Ruth. Because unlike the other three women, she doesn't have the sexually sordid backstory. She's not a victim of abuse. And yet to the Jewish person hearing Matthew's account, her appearance would be offensive. Why? Like Rahab, Ruth wasn't Jewish. But not only was Ruth not Jewish, she was a Moabite. The Moabites were not just Gentiles. They were one of Israel's sworn enemies. They weren't even allowed to enter the worship gathering of Israel. They were idolaters who refused to help Israel when they were making their way to the promised land from Egypt. But a famine in Israel sent a Jewish family, Naomi and Elimelech and their two sons, to Moab to survive. And, you know, Ruth's life was one of very much difficulty and sorrow. She saw her husband, her brother-in-law and her father-in-law perish in Moab. When Naomi, her mother-in-law, sought to return to her homeland, Ruth made an interesting choice. She followed her. And she chose, this Moabitess chose to worship Naomi's God. That famous passage that said, where you go, I'll go. And she eventually became the husband of Boaz and the great-grandmother of King David. I love the book of Ruth. It tells beautifully the story of Boaz as Ruth's kinsman redeemer, the one with power and resources. This is Boaz to rescue and protect the vulnerable in Ruth. And again, her appearance here in the opening pages of Christmas remind us that Jesus is the redeemer, not just of those on the inside, but of those who are on the outside looking in. And Ephesians says, this is who we are. We are alienated from the life of God. We were the outsiders. We are alien to the courts of the Almighty and are now brought in as full participants of the grace of God. I just want to end with this and say, if you are a Christian, you who were once an outsider are a son and daughter of the King. You dine at the King's table. So hopefully you'll never read the first chapter of Matthew the same way again. You won't skip over those names. I hope not. But more importantly, I hope that you understand that Jesus is more than just a name in the Bible. He is the son of Abraham, the son of David. He is the Christ. And I want to tell you this, that the world may forget your name, but your name can be known and named by the one who is the name above every name. Jesus can give you a name. Your name is also, if you are in Jesus, written on in the Lamb's Book of Life. Your name is in the family of God. This is the real meaning of Christmas, that God is in the business of taking sinners like you and me, making us new creations with new identities, a new purpose, and a new name. What a great message of Christmas, and I hope you take that to heart as you worship, as you listen to music, as you read the Bible, that your heart and your affections are bent and stirred toward this Jesus. Thank you for joining me on The Characters of Christmas.
The Characters of Christmas podcast is a production of LifeAudio.com and the Salem Web Network. This Christmas season, we hope you'll also check out Dan's book, The Characters of Christmas, The Unlikely People Caught Up in the Story of Jesus. It's available for Moody Publishers on Amazon.com or wherever you buy your books. You can find more from Dan and all his latest books and podcasts by visiting his website, DanielDarling.com. If you liked what you just listened to, would you take a second and tell your friends about us? And maybe also leave us a rating on your favorite podcast app. This podcast is produced by Kelly Givens and Stephen Sanders, with editorial oversight provided by me, Stephen McGarvey. To find more great Christian podcasts like this, check out the rest of our shows at LifeAudio.com.
Our world can feel chaotic and uncertain, but we don't have to live enslaved to fear. Christ has promised me and you his peace, and throughout Scripture has provided powerful tools and practical steps to help us experience greater freedom. I'm Jennifer Slattery, lead host of the Faith Over Fear podcast, inviting you to join me and my team as together we learn how to starve our fears and feed our faith. Subscribe at lifeaudio.com or wherever you access podcast content.